From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Captain Kevin Randall joins us as he talks about Roswell and other topics out of this world. Here's what's happening. Well, first they pointed a finger at Spanish cucumbers. Then they cast suspicion on sprouts from Germany. Now German officials just don't know what's going on. They're dumbfounded as to the source of the deadliest E. coli outbreak in modern history. And one U.S. expert calls this investigation there a disaster. Backtracking for the second time in a week now, the officials in Germany said preliminary tests have found no evidence now that vegetable sprouts from an organic farm in northern Germany were to blame. The surprise U-turn came only a day after the same state agency held a news conference to announce that the sprouts appeared to be the culprit in the outbreak that has killed now 22 people, sickened more than 2,300 others across Europe, most of them in Germany, over the past month. I suspect there's something else afoot here, but we shall see. Japan's nuclear power plant experienced full meltdowns at three reactors in the wake of an earthquake and tsunami in March. The new evaluation goes further than previous statements in describing the extent of the damage caused by an earthquake and tsunami on March 11th. The problem with their report is everybody else on this planet knew that they had meltdowns before the Japanese even considered telling the world. An online auction of Unabomber Ted Kaczynski's personal belongings generated almost $250,000 to compensate his victims and families. The federal government held the court-ordered sale from May 18th until last Thursday as bidders snapped up 58 lots of items seized from Kaczynski during a 1996 raid on his remote cabin. The highest-selling lot was a collection of 20 personal journals that Kaczynski had kept that described his thoughts about himself, society, and life in the wilds of Montana. That went for $40,000. Kaczynski became one of America's most notorious criminals for killing three people, wounding more than 20 victims with homemade bombs sent by post from 1978 to 1995. A story we reported on yesterday from England. A British hypnotist's subjects were temporarily left in a trance when he was knocked unconscious during a show. David Days was performing a hypnotism demonstration when he tripped over an audience member's leg and was knocked unconscious by the fall. When he fell, he was in the process of bringing three volunteers from the audience out of a hypnotic trance. Well, finally, he regained consciousness a few minutes later and was able to bring these three audience members back to consciousness. Dr. Bruce Goldberg, expert on hypnotherapy, with us. Bruce, what would have happened had this guy died? Would they ever have been able to bring these three out of it?
George, this is such a silly story. They would have come out of this naturally because hypnosis is a natural state of mind. I've worked with over 15,000 patients and have never had a problem. Think of when people drive on the freeways or highways and they pass by the same exits and don't realize moment to moment what goes on. That's a daydream level. We do that for about 4 hours a day, broken up into bits and pieces, watching TV, working on the computer, reading a book, listening to music, etc. And then you add 3 hours at night during your dream or REM cycle. You're talking about 7 hours every 24 hours we spend in what we call a natural daydream or alpha brainwave level. So the average 40-year-old listener out there has spent 100,000 hours in hypnosis. If the hypnotist leaves the field, dies, takes a plane, whatever they do, you will come out of it naturally just like you come out of a daydream and go back into your normal conscious waking state. So there's absolutely no danger whatsoever. The only danger is a bad stage hypnotist act.
All right, very good. Thanks, Bruce. Bruce, website, by the way, drbrucegoldberg.com. Versatile singer-songwriter Andrew Gold, who played chart success in the 1970s with this song, Lonely Boy, is dead. He died in his sleep. He was 59 years old. The Los Angeles Times says he died at his home. He had been undergoing cancer treatment but was responding well to treatment. A man who describes himself as an armchair astronomer claims he's found a strange structure on the surface of the red planet, Mars, after using the Google Mars search. Though more professional astronomers are yet to be convinced, David Martinez has already dubbed his find Biostasin Alpha and claims it's evidence of extraterrestrial life. Martin says he was scanning Google Mars when he stumbled on the discovery, which he says is a 700-foot-long, 150-foot-wide cylindrical structure. He says it could be a power station, or it could be a biological containment, or it could be a glorified garage. He doesn't think it's a weapon. On coasttocoastam.com, if you go to our highlights reel, you'll take a look at this picture. It is bizarre. And here's Martins as he posted on YouTube.
This is a video of something that I discovered on Google Mars quite by accident. I call it Biostation Alpha because, well, I'm just assuming that something's living in it or has lived in it or is going to be living in it. It's very unusual in that it's quite large. It's over 700 feet long and 150 feet wide. It looks like it's a cylinder or made up of cylinders, cylinder shapes. It could be a power station, or it could be a biological containment, or it could be a glorified garage. Hope it's not a weapon. Whoever put it up there had a purpose, I'm sure. I couldn't imagine what the purpose was. I couldn't imagine why anybody would want to live on Mars. Could be just a way station, just a place for weary space travelers. They don't have to come to Earth. It could also belong to NASA. I don't know that they would admit that, or that they could pull off such a project without people seeing all the material going up there. I sort of doubt NASA has anything to do with this. I don't even know if NASA knows about this. It would be very interesting to get a higher resolution image of this region and see if you could find it there. I don't know if that's available. I've looked on the internet and I can't really find any high resolution images of this region. Appears fairly well maintained. Clearly, it's not a rock. It's not a mountain, and I don't believe that we have any rovers up there that are 700 feet by 150 feet. So there it is. If any of you YouTubers have anything to say about this, I'd really be interested in hearing about it. Maybe you can go there and see for yourself. It's very intriguing, so please reply and let me know what you think. I don't know what else to say. I'm just going to let Google Mars sort of take us out here and kind of get a general idea of where it's located. I'll go ahead and post the coordinates on my YouTube site, and then you can go there and cut and paste them. Copy paste, however you do it. And go see for yourself.
Okay, so there you have it. What the heck is it? You can take a look at it at coasttocoastam.com. Lex has posted it under our highlights reel. It is a strange-looking structure, whatever it might be. And, of course, Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor and head of the enterprisemission.com, the man responsible for the book Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, who also discussed what was going on at Cydonia, that face. Here he is to react to this story. Richard, what does this look like to you?
Well, it looks like a space station, and it's not. Be still my beating heart. You know, I've had this probably posted 100 times on my Facebook pages in the last couple, 3 days. When this story broke, what I did was what any scientist does. You have to go to original data. What most people don't understand is that Google Mars is not an original data source. What they've done is to take images of Mars from NASA, from ESA, from, I think, even the old Soviet Union, some of those images.
Uh-huh.
And they pasted them together with sophisticated software so you can zoom in on any part of Mars and basically see what the current imagery database is showing you. The problem is in stitching the photos together. So what I did, and a lot of other people on the web have done, is to go to the original source. It turns out this object is on an ESA image from Mars Express taken a couple, 3 years ago of the North Polar regions. It's pretty, you know, pretty desolate there. And I was able to download and then convert with the NASA software, the IMG program into a TIFF file. And you zoom in and you look at this thing. And what it is, George, is it's a series of perfect square little pixels separated by a black pixel in between in a absolutely horizontal line or orthogonally coordinated with the frame of the picture.
So they're digital anomalies, basically.
It's basically a digital anomaly. Now, what's really weird, and the part that I don't get yet, is when you compare the black and white original, it's literally a series of one pixels. I think there's maybe 10 or 12 of them in a perfect line with black spacing in between. So it looks like dot, dash, dot, dash, dot, dash, dot, dash. How that got translated in the Google software, so you have a thing that looks much bigger, it looks like a tube, and it looks like it's got color stripes on it.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine how this astronomer went crazy when he saw this.
Well, anybody would unless they understand the process. Now, here's where I get, pardon the expression, conspiratorial. Remember Jurassic Park?
Yes.
Remember the great film with what we called?
I loved it.
Yeah, of course, we all did. Remember the mad programmer?
Yep.
Who was paid by the corporation to sabotage certain things?
You're not suggesting.
I am suggesting that there is a mad programmer in Google, not being paid by Google, obviously, but just someone having some fun. And what he did was he took this little digital scratch and he added color to it. He added dimension. He added a roundness. In other words, he added all the things that make it look really cool, and none of them, George, are real.
Oh.
I've got a zillion pictures of real artifacts on Mars. They're a little bit older than this thing because they're ancient. They come from the period of Mars when it was inhabited, and they're all over the planet, and I'm not the only one. There are people all over the world who've been using the original databases, MRO, you know, the Russian missions, the NASA missions, Mars Surveyor, Mars Odyssey, and you know, even Mariner 9, to do really good, excellent imaging work and find the artifacts that are there, to say nothing of the stuff we've now seen from the rovers. But this object on Google Mars is not anything. It looks like a hoax.
And we all wanted this to be real, Richard. We really did. Richard's website, enterprisemission.com. But go take a look at this object. It is fascinating. Up next, what happens if 130 million people go without electricity? Can you imagine that? We'll be talking with Lawrence Joseph in a moment. Aftermath on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Lawrence Joseph with us this hour, researcher, journalist, investigator. He's written on science, nature, politics, and also the possibility of an apocalypse in 2012. Aftermath is his work, a guide to preparing for and surviving 2012. What happens, for example, if 120 million people, because of a catastrophe, are without power? Here's Lawrence Joseph back on Coast to Coast. Lawrence, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm glad to be back on the show.
My pleasure. Tell me about these possibilities, because they are real. What could happen?
Well, it's very likely that we're going to be hit with a solar blast, which is basically an eruption that comes from the sun and hits the Earth, that will knock out some or all of our electrical power grids and deprive us of electricity for months or years. This is not my private assumption or some research that I gathered on the QT. This is according to the National Academy of Sciences, a major report published in December 2008. Co-sponsored by NASA. It's been taken so seriously that the United States House of Representatives voted unanimously to take measures to protect our power grids against such a blast. Unfortunately, the Senate scuttled the legislation entirely. So we're looking at not only the hypothetical possibility or even the low probability, but the high probability. It's going to happen. The question is when. And we all can can indulge ourselves in the grim imagination of what it would be like to be without electricity for months or years. But just think, it's not just telecom that goes down. It's not just that we couldn't listen to this wonderful show or we couldn't call our friends about it. There's precious little water or gasoline because the pumps are electric. Refrigeration for fresh food or medicine? No. Basic law enforcement and military security either compromised or gone entirely.
You couldn't even call 911 for help.
You could hit those buttons all night long, but nothing's going to happen.
ATMs, can't get your cash out.
That's right. Funds transfers are all electronic nowadays.
And how long? How long would this continue, Lawrence?
Well, they don't know, but again, according to severe space weather, the severe space weather report issued by the National Academy of Sciences, it could go for months or years.
Now, the only good part about this is whoever gets blasted is going to be facing, for example, the sun if an X-flare hits. The country on the other side at the time, they could be okay, right?
Well, here's the way it tends to work out. The countries that are closest to the poles, the closer you are to the poles, the likelier you are to be devastated because
the
Earth's magnetic field is weakest at the poles. I mean, we can all remember from high school, you imagine a bar magnet, and you notice that the magnetic lines of force come out of the top and then flare out and then go back in the bottom.
Right.
That's where the Earth is. Same kind of situation. So you don't want to be a heavily electricity-dependent civilization near the poles, which, unfortunately, the United States is relatively close, and so is all of Western Europe, much of Russia, and a fair port a bit of northern China.
Are any other countries ahead of us in terms of insulating and protecting their grid?
To the best of my knowledge, no. I attended a 19-nation summit conference at Parliament in London last year. The good news was it was a fascinating collection of defense ministers and top scientists from just about everywhere with advanced industrial society. The bad news is we were sworn to secrecy.
Tell us, Lawrence. Tell us.
The only thing I can tell you is pray, and I'm not kidding. Pray. They being of a bureaucratic mentality and also of a protective sorts, they feared the panic more than the danger.
Yeah,
they
absolutely
fear the fear.
And that's why they don't want to say anything.
Yeah. Now, there is something to fear. I mean, I'm not a big fan of inciting panic. I don't think there's necessarily anything good about it in and of itself. But fear is warranted when danger is at hand.
Well, you know, even today, when I was thinking about this in your work with Aftermath, I was saying to myself, the things that have been going on this planet recently, the horror of Joplin, Missouri, which really strikes home for me, and all these episodes that are occurring on this planet, this is all we need on this planet, but some kind of an X flare to hit us and knock out our electrical grid. I mean, to me, it would be the last straw, Lawrence.
It would, because we'd kick ourselves in the butts, because the thing about this doomsday scenario is that there's a way of preventing it. This is the thing, I've bored many of friends by going on and, you know, we're supposed to be in a party mood or at a dinner. I keep going on about this. And
oh, I bet you're great at a party.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get rid of you.
Yeah, those invitations just keep getting lost in the email. But I never thought that I've been writing about science topics and political topics for almost 30 years. Cut my teeth by writing a lot for the New York Times, and I've written books, and I never thought that my career would add up, my life's work would add up to surge suppressors. You know, it just doesn't have that romantic, inspirational feel to it.
And you know, we've dodged the bullet before. We've been lucky. We've had X flares from the sun. We weren't directly in alignment. We've been lucky, Lawrence.
We have. And that was one thing I really tried to challenge this report, this National Academy of Sciences report. Say, well, okay, hypothetically, a glob of the sun could fall and hit the Earth, and it would be, you know, all hell to pay. Is that what we're talking about? Some technicality of a possibility? But no. In 1859 and in 1921, we were hit with major solar blasts that were the same size ones to hit today, would knock out our power grid.
And knocked out the whole telegraph in those days, too. Lawrence, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take phone calls with you. We're going to get some tips from you on what we might be able to do. And also with these calls, here's something I'd like you to think about before you call. What situation have you gone through where you were without power for a day or 3 days or a little longer? What was it like for you? Share that story with us when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Captain Kevin Randall joins us as we talk about his incredible UFO investigations. And we'll be back with your calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Lawrence Joseph. Well, Lawrence, if government's not going to step in and save us, what do we do? What can we do as individuals?
Precious little. I'm sorry. I know it's the politically incorrect answer. We can go off grid and we can go solar and we can take care of ourselves in many ways, and that's all helpful. But I don't want to be the only house on the block with electricity when the lights go out, you know?
It'll be like the old Twilight Zone movie. The whole neighborhood would storm you.
They sure would. But here's something that we can do, and I need your help with this, George, and I'm not kidding. 1 year from today, exactly, 1 year from today, the Earth Summit of 2012 will be concluding in Rio de Janeiro. It'll be 20 years after the United Nations Earth Summit of 1992, which had 112 heads of state, which drew 50,000 people from around the world, and which essentially galvanized the environmental movement into a global movement, into a global cooperation. I was at that Earth Summit. I intend to be at the next one. What I intend to do is make sure one way or another that what I consider to be one of the most catastrophic environmental threats, that is, of solar blasts against our power grid, is discussed by these heads of state and some agreement is made. Right now, it's not on the agenda. We have a year to get it on the agenda. We have to go down there, and like I said, I'm going. And if necessary, use a little theatrics and steal the world stage and make sure that this problem is not overlooked. What I need from you is when I come back, I want to be able to tell what's happened.
Oh, you got a deal. You have a deal, and let's hope nothing happens in between. But you know what? It very well could.
You know what? I'm so upset about this that I really would be perversely, I suppose, happy if a little slap to the face. You know, there used to be that old commercial, probably before you can remember, most of your listeners. Well, there's this smack and thanks. I needed that. It was for an aftershave, and we need a little slap in the face, I think, because as much as we argue and make the case, and I mean, even get those congressmen who, you know, they won't cross the aisle to perform a Heimlich maneuver, but they'll vote unanimously on to take care of this. Even all that doesn't do the job like one, you know, couple of days blackout or across the northern part of the country. That'll get attention, and hopefully we'll do so without too much devastation.
Well, regardless of where it would hit, you know, China, Russia, any place, I think it would surely open the minds of a lot of people, don't you?
Well, you know, I think you have a pure heart. In 2003, there was a storm that hit on actually right on Halloween, known as the Halloween Storm of 2003, and it knocked out 14 transformers in South Africa, and it crippled that country's electrical utility for years. I mean, I have friends in there. I know that just, you know, and you think, well, South Africa's probably got its share of problems anyway. But no, they weren't. It took them years to recover. But people thought, well, it's, you know, it's a country, a third world country. It's far away. Nobody cared. If Western Europe goes down, if the United States goes down, portions of China, yeah, then notice will be taken.
I did a show a couple months ago in St. Louis on a generator, and it lasted long enough to do the complete program, and then it all died out. You know, it's got like a 4.5 hour life span to it, and thank God the power went out right before the show and the generators kicked in, and you know, I was okay. But I got to tell you, it is bizarre. We're going to take some calls here, Lawrence. To go without power for just a few hours is weird. I mean, it's just weird.
Yes, it is.
Let's take some calls. Let's go, first of all, to Holbrook, Arizona. Catherine's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hey.
When we moved out here in 77, we didn't have electricity for 3 years.
Wow.
It was interesting. We went to bed with the chickens. We rose with the birds.
But you did that by design, right?
Well, no, actually, we did that with stupidity. We were ignorant, and we thought, the electricity would be here. And it turned out the company wanted $10,000 to go maybe a quarter of a mile, bring a line down, and we just didn't have it.
Oh, my God. What'd you do? How'd you get by?
Well, we did have a generator. We ran for a while, and we still to this day have a wood stove. We still have power outages, and we just put up with it. But it's interesting.
I still think, Lawrence, we should all have some kind of solar device in our houses, don't you?
Absolutely. And, backup devices, solar being the best, just a little generator is helpful, although the fuel supply is problematic. I think, Catherine, you've got a potential career as a consultant here, because just having gone through that and knowing the tricks of the trade, I'm sure you could advise most of us, because most of us, I think, have gone a couple of days, maybe at most, without electricity.
I'd go nuts after that.
Wouldn't
you?
Yeah.
Next up, we go to Robert in Oklahoma City. Hey, Robert, thanks for calling.
Morning.
Hi.
Well, I'm of the firm belief of a little bit of balance. I do something that most people don't do. Maybe they do, but I will deliberately stay without power for maybe a week or a month from time to time. And I noticed, I feel like I'm coming up out of a trance, like I'm waking up sometimes when I do that, and I start noticing things that I normally wouldn't notice. But
you do this on purpose, though, Robert? You just, shut everything down? What do you do?
Well, I'll deliberately shut things down, because I firmly believe in order for me to get centered and in touch with myself and my own energy, I have to do that. And you know how you talk about the awakening? I literally feel like I'm waking up from a trance when I do that. Now, I'll turn the power back on, and then I feel like I'm kind of going back into a trance. But I'm telling you, not only that, when I do that, I start thinking better. My memory comes back better. I start doing retrospect, and everything just starts seeming very, very clear.
When you turn the power back on, Robert, what necessitates that? Do you do it because you just have to, or you want to?
Well, I do it to kind of keep up with what's going on in the world, just to kind of keep up with the information, and I do it kind of like a balance there, and that kind of helps me, stay centered.
You do have a battery-operated radio, though, to listen to the show, right?
Yeah, but like I said, I tell you what, though, I'll turn that TV off for a month, and I'm telling you, I feel like I'm waking up out of a trance. It's amazing, and I feel, and not only that, I feel calmer.
Okay, Lawrence, explain for us, Robert. That's a great story, by the way.
It is.
Explain to us, Lawrence, what life would be like for 2 weeks without power. Everything is shut down. Just give us a synopsis here.
Well, everything is shut down. The impulse to hop in your car and get away from it, where your it might be, is tempered by the fact that you won't be able to get gasoline along the way.
Most likely. If you've got a full tank, you're as good as that until
that's
it's
right.
gone.
That's right. If you're lucky enough to have a full tank, and that's it, because those pumps require electricity. 2 weeks, my former in-laws went for 2 weeks without electricity in Houston, and they're resourceful folks, and grew up on the land and know what to do. And it sounds like our caller has no shortage of skills like that as well. 2 weeks, we could ride it out and tell the stories. The folks who would suffer are those who are ill or frail. Diabetics would have a difficult time, most likely. And
hospitals, what a disaster.
Yeah, but you get on up towards the cataclysm point seems to me to be about 4 to 6 weeks. That's when, among other things, the nuclear power plants, which depend on large supplies of electricity from conventional power plants, don't get it. If they don't get it, you have your
meltdowns.
Yeah, and you have a string of them across the country.
If you can't keep that water cool,
that's right.
You have a meltdown.
That's
indeed.
Right. And then, you know, way before that, when once the perception becomes that it's not just a temporary thing, that the power won't come back on any minute, but this is either a permanent or an ongoing and indefinite situation, then you've got predatory folks and desperate folks, and then you've got the social breakdown and the meltdown of law and order that I mean, nobody can definitively predict at what point that'll start, but once it becomes general knowledge or suspicion that this is not something that they just haven't thrown the switch yet, but this, you know, these switches could remain on and off and on and off and
right.
mostly off, then you've got people that are going to go out scavenging, either, you know, because they need to or because they want to or because they're a gang of them, and, you know, that's a scary, scary situation.
Well, you know, maybe that's the time you should be glad one has a gun if one owns one, because, you know, you're right. Lawlessness is going to prevail. People are going to loot, try to break into your house.
Yeah.
They're going to do whatever they have to do to survive. At what point into this do you think the mass deaths start to occur? Not 2 weeks, but when? A month? 2 months?
I think it's 4 to 6 weeks, and then you have things like the sewage treatment plants are inoperative, and you've got a real spread of disease, and you've got this, you know, gun violence, and hospitals which do have backup generators run through that supply, and so not only are the sick folks in there at risk, but those who fall sick can't be treated properly.
You know how many of us take it for granted? You flush the toilet and you don't even worry about anything else. You know, you don't worry about where things go or what happens. I'd like to just get some experts. I think I'll call my friends down at the Metropolitan Sewer District in St. Louis. I'd like to know the process of just what happens. I mean, how big are these tubes, and where do things go, and how do they clean things up? And, you know, as many people should know, that a lot of that water that comes out of your sewer, isn't that reprocessed after they filter it out into drinking water?
Yes.
All right, let's go to Mike in Phoenix, Arizona. First-time caller. Hi, Mike.
Hi, it's good to talk to you. Hi,
thanks.
George. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi.
Well, my scenario isn't as bad as what you guys just covered.
Good.
My life has definitely changed the last couple of months. The last 20 years, as a cellular phone technician, they walked 20 of us last year. So I'm taking time off right now to build a house, and I'm building it myself mostly. I've got some family that shows up on the weekends now and then. But when I bought the house, we elected not to turn on the electricity right away because we were going to be moving walls, and just it's kind of like the same as a 32 Ford chassis restoration.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm charging my cellular phone by the driving in the truck. I've got an inverter in the truck that charges the laptop. I've been able to hook up in the neighborhood now and then, finding a rogue system that's unsecure. Little tricks like this. I live in a cooler, or out of a cooler, and I buy the ice now and then. And in Phoenix, you know, it's starting to get a little warm. I have water in the house, and I'm due for a framing inspection this week, so it's coming up. But you know, like Catherine and Holbrook, you know, up with the chickens or whatever. I am following the light right now, and I'm telling the family, you know, I got to get home. It's getting dark. As a cellular phone technician, I saw some interesting things during my time in there, and I come up with a thing in the house that I call the smart box. Now, I have 4 solar panels that are going on the roof, and I have Cat 5 run into this smart box, audio, video, just everything goes into there and then off to the different places, as well as an extension cord, if you will, from the solar, in which case any little part of the house that I want to plug in, such as the freezer, the media wall, the computer office, or the master suite, can be plugged into that smart box.
That's a good idea.
And I got a smart box from reading about smart grid.
And can any house do this, Mike? Can anybody change their house?
They have as they call them, control boxes and that, where they have the TV, the telephone, and the internet and that plugged in. I took it a step further and just took a line from the power grid and a line from the solar, and then ran some junction boxes in there to where I can. And I'm hoping in the next 5 years there's going to be even more nice little residential boxes that can automatically switch this for me.
Oh, that's a good idea.
May I make a suggestion with your smart box?
Yeah, go ahead, Lawrence.
Harden it. And by that I mean encase it in something that will protect it. Lead would be an extreme choice.
Insulate it.
Insulate it from a solar blast, because that box could be knocked out the same way the transformers and the grid would be. And satellites are routinely hardened with their special casing metals. It's the lead principle, but just protect that box, because you don't want to be having solar power fed into it and then have the junction box be shorted out by a solar blast.
Good point. Let's go to Mary now in San Luis Obispo in California. West of the Rockies. Hi, Mary.
Well, how do you do? Thank you, George, for having me on.
Sure.
Just before I got on the phone, you had mentioned, an experience where you had been cut out. When I was a kid, one of the kids in the neighborhood had a birthday, so we had gone to see Chucko the Clown. And coming home, I think this was October 12th, 1959, we came up the hill, and it looked like the gates of hell had opened.
Oh.
There was the fire, the great L.A. fire.
Oh, yeah.
And it went from Tujunga all the way out to San Bernardino. And our saving grace, we were right next to JPL. So we had an immediate response team. But for 10 days, we were not even allowed to get back into our home. And I was panicked because I was a little kid. My mom was an invalid at home. She had a stroke. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, we're never going to get my mom out, But by the time we finally got back, remember this is 1959, so Cold War, duck and cover, everyone had food stored. And the one thing I think that's going to save us in the event of the big blackout or whatever, know your neighbor. One thing that happened after that emergency, of course in 59 we all knew our neighbors, but after that, so-and-so stored such and such food, so-and-so was assigned a generator, the neighborhood got together and everyone had a way to give, to be self-sustaining, to help the entire community. So, somebody had a deep freeze, so the generator would have to go to save the food. And so-and-so had places to store the dry goods or the canned goods or sleeping or bedding or toys for the kids.
Well, that is the only way it's going to work, Mary and Lawrence. If people in a community join together during this kind of a catastrophe. And it's just not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, isn't it, Lawrence?
Absolutely. I get asked by a lot of folks what to do, and should they head for the hills or whatever. I say, no, you take refuge in your own life and in your community. And I've advised a number of people on formulating what I call a family emergency plan. And it can be a family or a community or a neighborhood, whatever your unit is organized. It certainly isn't limited to blood relatives, but divide labors. Who's in charge of what? Where do you meet in case you can't communicate? Do everything that your neighbors seem instinctively to know how to do.
Now, it could be. Indeed. Lawrence, when you need help, when you go to this conference, you let us know. We're there for you. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Captain Kevin Randall. Crash when UFOs fall from the sky.